Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
As the nation honors Dr. King, one city struggles with a racist past.
I've heard stories of people of color who refused to get off at exit 137 that said Howell to get gas because they knew they'd be beaten up.
Howell, Michigan, and the ghosts of the Klan. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Bill Radke. Photography is tricky when the subject won't stand still.
And yes, you do break a lot, but, you know, they are falling out of the sky, so one just goes and gets another one.
Meet Kenneth Liebrecht, professional snowflake photographer. Also icy, relations between fans of Duke and North Carolina's basketball teams.
Why do you hate them, he asked. Here I hesitated. A young boy had asked me a guileless question, and he needed an adult response. The truth is, they are terrible people, I told him. Detestable.
Ah, sportsmanship. On Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And in Seattle, I'm John Moe in for Desiree Cooper. Snow is falling in many parts of the country this weekend. You can play in it, you can shovel it, maybe you can curse at it a little, or you can photograph it using high-powered microscopes. We'll meet a guy who's choosing that last option. Plus, how to tell a joke, advice from a world champion joke teller who has somehow never walked into a bar with a priest, a rabbi, and a duck. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I have so many things to do, I can't believe it. I have to go to a Bible class. I have to go to a lecture.
I'm probably going to go to a friend's house or go to a movie.
My niece is coming down from Boston, and she's staying for a couple of days, and we're going out to Long Island.
I have two birthday parties to go to, one for a 6-year-old and one for a 26-year-old.
This weekend, I'm waiting for the baby to come. I'm 39 weeks pregnant.
This weekend, I am going to be helping my mom shoveling mulch.
And hopefully her mom is not the pregnant woman we met just a moment ago.
Those voices came from Brooklyn, San Francisco, and Las Vegas.
Well, the Martin Luther King holiday holds special meaning for Weekend America's co-host, Desiree Cooper. This weekend, she is at a Northern Michigan retreat with family and friends contemplating and discussing the civil rights leader's legacy. But before she took off, she stopped at an unlikely place to gauge the progress of King's dream of racial equality, Howell, Michigan. Des says the town of 9,000 hasn't changed that much since it was established as a close-knit sawmill town in the 1800s. But the last few decades, Howell has been known for something that most residents wish it weren't.
We have Melon Fest, which is one of the things Howell's known for, is Howell Melon Fest.
That's Kate Dofer. I found her this week serving coffee at Howell's Uptown Coffee House.
What else is Howell known for?
Howell's known for... has an undeserved reputation for being racist, which I think comes from some guy who was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who actually lived 10 miles north of here in Cahokta. I think they picked Howell as a name because, as an identifier from where all this activity was, because it's easier to spell than Cahokta. It's also easier to say.
Kate's talking about Klan leader Robert Miles. In the 1970s, he went to prison for bombing empty school buses during the desegregation of the Pontiac Public Schools. Klan rallies on his farm made the area a magnet for white supremacists. He died in 1992, but that reputation hasn't. And it's not all undeserved. Klansmen once paraded down Howell streets. Steve Manner is a retired teacher and Howell City Councilman. He remembers another incident 20 years ago.
The lady that was the head of that family is Shirley Griffin, and she literally woke up in the night and there was a cross burning on her lawn. She called the police. They responded. The authorities, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, were involved. They apprehended the people that did it.
For Steve and others, that wasn't enough. They formed a council to address racism in the entire county, the Livingston Diversity Council. They once held an exhibit of Jim Crow memorabilia in the town's opera house. and they've had frank town meetings about racism. Pat Convery heads the Howell Area Chamber of Commerce, and she's an active member of the committee.
I've heard stories of people of color who refused to get off at exit 137 that said Howell to get gas because they knew they'd be beaten up. But that shocked me. And it shocked the other people in the conversation, because it's not true.
The hearsay is a big hurdle for Howell to overcome, but Pat says they have to keep trying.
Is it wrong for me to be happy to go out at lunchtime and see a couple of African-American people go in a restaurant? And I said, I almost want to go up and say, hey, welcome. Of course I don't. You know, it was a person who was African-American said, you know, people look at me when I'm in hell. And I said, well, I'm probably one of the people because I'm going, yes. You know,
having those kinds of discussions has been great. But 2 years ago, they had a bigger issue to deal with. A local auctioneer came upon a stash of Klan robes, buttons, posters, a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf. He decided to auction the whole lot in downtown Howell on the King holiday weekend. Residents groaned, here we go again. The Diversity Council was able to pressure the auctioneer to move the date. Meanwhile, Candy Hinton had just moved to the county. She's an African-American realtor.
The first week that I was here, I was sitting on boxes, and I looked down at the newspaper, and it said KKK auction. And so I was literally trying to read the paper, and the door, someone knocked on the door. And they said, hi, we're here to collect items for the auction. And I said, oh, seriously? And I just slammed the door in her face, and I thought, okay, we're going to have to move. Come to find out, the lady that was collecting for the auction was actually collecting for an elementary auction that was down the street that was happening at the same time, but I didn't know that.
Since then, Candy's had ups and downs living and working in the area.
There are times that I may run into a bit of resistance because they're not sure if I'm the customer or the realtor.
So they're more comfortable with you being the realtor than a customer?
Yeah.
Still, she emphasizes that she likes living there. And day in and day out, race isn't a big deal. Back at the coffee shop, Kate Dofer says Howell's reputation is hard on everybody.
My children are both in band, and we've gone to band things at like Wald Lake East, and my children have actually had people yelling at them, saying, Howell, you're racist. Get out of here.
Meanwhile, realtor Candy Hinton says it's only a matter of time before globalism and diversity come to Howell, whether they're ready or not.
It is no longer a completely all-white society or area. So when people say, well, we never had that problem here, it's because it's never been in your face. It's never showed up, and it's never sat by you.
This month, Candy became the first Black president of the Livingston Diversity Council. She says this is her chance to help turn Howell into a place where everyone would want to live, no matter their color.
That's Weekend America host Desiree Cooper in Howell, Michigan. Yesterday, the Livingston Diversity Committee invited Jane Elliott to hold a workshop in Howell. Now, in 1968, Jane was a teacher in Iowa. She became famous for dividing up her class by eye color. It was an experiment to teach the students about discrimination. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated the day before, and she felt the issue of racism and discrimination simply needed to be addressed. It was a controversial lesson, to say the least. Her parents lost their business. Her own kids were taunted and beaten up. Jane was an outcast, but she kept teaching the lesson. Almost 40 years later, Jane's calendar is now packed. Corporations hire Jane to teach her lesson to their employees. And earlier this week, she spoke with Desiree Cooper.
So, Jane, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What have you learned when you teach the brown eye, blue eye lesson to adults?
The first thing you find out is when you put adult, blue-eyed, white males through an exercise in discrimination based on the color of their eyes, they immediately act like third graders.
What do you mean?
Well, they can't function. They can't spell. They can't respond. They can't read properly. They're angry. They're sad. They're infuriated. They riot. I've been hit. They become violent. I've been hit by a white male during this exercise in a corporation.
What happens in the session that makes
that kind of reaction?
Well, the first place, you make them stay outside the room for about an hour in a room in which there's no coffee, there's no goodies, there's nothing pleasant. And you tell the brown-eyed people what you're going to do. You give them the rules for the day. You teach them the listening skills very, very quickly. And you have signs on the wall that say things like, blue-eyed people and dogs keep out. If I have only one life to live, let me live it as a brown. Those kinds of signs, illustrated, are all around the room. And after you have gotten the brown-eyed people prepared to go along with you with this exercise, after you have intimidated and seduced them into going along, you bring the non-brown-eyed people into the room, and the chairs are set up so that the brown-eyed people are sitting on each side of the blue-eyed chairs, and they're facing one another across the blue-eyed chairs. And then you make them sit down in the chairs in the middle, and there are only half enough chairs for the non-brown-eyed people. That makes them angry right away because they want to sit where the brown-eyed people are, but they can't do that. You know how these people are. They always want to be where they aren't wanted. So you make them sit down, and then you make some of them sit on the floor. And that's a real no-no for adult white males.
Do people defy you? Do people say, you know what, we're not doing this anymore?
Yeah, and I say, hey, here's the way it is. Your job description for today is to be here. We're going to run this exercise. Now you either stay or go. I don't care which you do. I get paid whichever you do. But you need to know that you're future employment in this corporation may very well depend on whether or not you've been through this exercise. Now, you do what you want to. Guess what they do? Hey, we do it with people of color and women all the time.
Do what?
We say you will work in this environment, whether it is racist or sexist. If you want this job, you will simply assimilate. If you don't want the job, there'll be another person. There'll be another woman or person of color who would like to have this job. You do what you want to do.
Now, you've described how some blue eyes or non-brown eyes can react to this immersion into a racist environment. How do people with the brown eyes react to it?
White brown-eyed people are just shocked and then delighted. People of color, first, don't want to go along because they know how it feels to be treated that way, and they don't want to do it. But then they realize, after you have described what you're going to do and why you're going to do it, that this could make a very big difference in their future in that corporation or in the military or on that university campus, wherever we're doing it, and then they go along. And they go along up to the point where you begin to tell blue-eyed jokes. And then they can see that they're beginning to enjoy this. And when they start to enjoy it, they pull back, and that's when you change. Then that's when you stop the exercise.
Why do you stop it there?
Because that's the place to stop it. When it begins to be fun, then you have to stop it. It has been fun for white people for years in this country. I don't want that to be a fun exercise. I want that to be an exercise that makes people realize how ugly racism is, that makes people aware of what the mechanics of racism are and why we need to put a stop to it.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you for joining us.
Well, once again, thank you for having me.
Learn more about Jane Elliott and the lessons she teaches at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Cloned meat is pronounced safe. Michigan jobs are pronounced gone. Clowns are pronounced scary. Good, bad, or no news next on Weekend America. Thank you. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. Our program is about the American weekend. Weekend events, weekend energy. Now we turn to weekend contemplation, when we have a moment to interpret the week's events as being good news, bad news, or no news. My mates today, Gustavo Arellano, who writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Hola, Gustavo.
Hola.
Performance artist Damali Ayo. Hi, Damali.
Hello, boys.
And writer-producer John Ridley. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you. Our first topic, the FDA says food from cloned animals and their offspring is safe to eat and drink. But is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I'm off cloning. Like literally the day they cloned Daisy the goat or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. Dolly the sheep?
Dolly the sheep.
Yes, Dolly the
or
sheep.
Or Daisy the goat or...
Billy the kid.
Yeah. Like every reproductive gene in my body just shut down. And that was the day I decided I was not having children. Yeah, so this whole... I mean, I'll eat it, but like, you know, I'm not going to stand for it. I think it's bad news.
Bad news. Okay.
You hate it. You're against it. Your body's shut down, but you'll eat it.
So that I don't have to live with the clones. I'll eat them so I don't have to live with them.
Live with the clones, hate the clones, bad news.
That's actually a really good philosophy. Kill the clones by eating them. I have to agree
with good.
That. I also think it's bad news, though, because we're now at the process of eating clones. And then the next step, of course, is Soylent Green. And if Soylent Green happens and the reality hits that Charlton Heston really was saying the truth all the way
correct.
Back to the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very, very bad news.
It's good news.
Huh?
This is good news.
Explain.
Because, I mean, look, all we do is ingest food that is not natural.
Right.
It's got preservatives, that got chemicals. For most people, that doesn't bother them. They don't think about it. You know, that's the rise of the fast food culture. Now we're talking about finding a way to take the best food that we have, to reproduce it in some fashion, and then distribute that food to people who don't have access to that food. So to me, the idea that we should be afraid of being able to feed the world and have better resources and not be afraid of running out of these resources, I think is fantastic. Why are we fighting the future? Don't fight the future.
Our next topic. Michigan has America's highest unemployment rate. John McCain told Michiganders those automotive jobs are never coming back and they'd better learn to compete in a global economy. Mitt Romney told Michiganders he's not declaring defeat. He's going to fight for those jobs. And Romney won the Republican primary there. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I'm all for bringing the jobs back. Not a big Mitt Romney fan, but I think it's good news to give people hope, you know, and it's good news to give people a little fight instead of saying, like, move on, suck it up, and what, learn how to code? You know, I don't...
Okay, good news.
Those jobs will run out eventually, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's no news. Mitt Romney won the state of Michigan because his father, George Romney, he was a governor of Michigan years back, and so it's almost, you know, he's playing in his own home state. McCain, he's an outsider. He's the Republican Party base isn't going to vote for him because they don't view him as a straight-ahead conservative. So it's really no news. I do think McCain had a Jimmy Carter moment in saying that those jobs aren't going to come back, and that might have shot him in the foot. But even if he didn't say that, I still think he would have lost.
You don't think Michigan voters were enchanted by Romney's fighting spirit?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I think it's no news for a different reason. I think you have a candidate who's being fairly straight with the electorate, saying, look, these jobs are gone. What we really need is re-education and different kinds of jobs. And people didn't want to hear that. You got to be straight with people. You know, Michigan needs different kinds of jobs. Kids in Michigan need to refocus their education on something else. But people didn't want to hear that. And I think that's unfortunate.
Our next topic. A growing number of schools are ditching traditional PE class in favor of teaching life skills through physical activity. So goodbye flag football, hello building a trail in the forest. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
It's the worst news I ever heard.
Huh?
It's horrible.
Horrible news.
Touchy, feely. Put a ball in a kid's hand and whip it at his head. You'll learn something. Learn to move your ass out of the way. That's what you learn.
Have you ever dug a trail in the forest? You're definitely moving and working then. I think it's fantastic news. Like, get those kids out. Give them some skills. Stop all this, overemphasis on sports.
What's wrong with sports?
Because it doesn't really turn out the kind of life skills. It turns out a lot of, you know, problematic, you know, competitive issues.
It's team effort. There's leadership. There's
That's so not
effort.
True.
It is about self-sacrifice. It is all
no,
of those wonderful
isn't.
Things. Yes.
Gustavo, help.
I agree. It's horrible news. You're going to learn many more life lessons in a game of dodgeball or Red Rover than you ever will building a trail in a freaking forest.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Why is that?
You learn life in playground sports. And
what
I'm not
about
even
digging
talking
out tree stumps and installing logs and planting native shrubs?
That should be its own thing. If people want to do that, you know, if kids want to waste their time in nature, let them do that. But I'm saying for...
A waste of time is flag football. You're just getting beat up by your obnoxious peers.
Well, then you got to learn to throw a punch.
You got to learn to run faster than those people.
Exactly. That's what life is all about.
Damali, you wouldn't mind that your kid is working for the Parks Department for free like a prison inmate?
Oh, you guys are out of your minds.
Okay, let's agree to agree not to agree.
Agreed.
Did you think that this one would be so contentious, Bill,
no.
That question?
Our final topic. A children's hospital in Sheffield, England asked 250 kids how they feel about hospital decor, and every one of them said no clowns. Even kids as old as 16 described clowns as scary, frightening, or unknowable. Now the study's been published in the magazine Nursing Standard. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
Good news.
Strange news. I do not get why people are so scared of clowns.
What?
I swear, I've never seen that before. My cousin, he saw the Stephen King movie, It. And then after he saw it, the following day, he woke up screaming and crying. And he was 18 years old. Sorry, Victor, for saying that. But, yeah, he woke up crying. What's so scary about clowns?
John Damali, can you help?
To me, clowns are scary just because they're weird. But, like, I have a question about what their history of clowning and what they represent and if they're related to blackface minstrelsy, which would make them even scarier to me.
On an intellectual level?
No, on a very visceral level.
Why are clowns scary? No one's answering my question.
No, I mean, honestly, they're creepy people who kill and put on disguises.
It's just John Wayne Gacy.
Are you saying the kids know that? The kids are scared
kids are intuitive.
On that level?
Dogs bark before an earthquake, and kids are naturally frightened of evil. And clowns are evil. I mean, that's just a fact.
What about Bozo and
Krusty.
Krusty. Well, maybe Bozo. So this is good, bad, or no news?
I think, seriously, it's good news.
Good news because?
Because if we're finding out that kids who are in hospitals who are already probably scared and obviously sick or injured or what have you don't like clowns and we can make their stay in a hospital a little bit better, I think that's good. Now, here's the really bad news. This is going to really mess up Ronald McDonald House. Because you have a confluence of an incredibly good humanitarian thing and the scariest MF on the planet.
Gustavo, do we ever answer your question?
No. No.
Panel, that's the news. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Always a pleasure.
John, you have no problem with clowns either. Huh?
I think they're delightful. I just don't see it.
Healthy, healthy man. Conceptual and performance artist Damali Ayo there. She's the author of How to Rent a Negro, and she's created the Now Art Grant program to support artists generating social change. Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man, and his latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Okay, a bartender walks into a church. Wait, no, a priest walks into a bartender. How's this? Knock, knock, who's there? Someone to screw in a light bulb. How to tell a joke, coming up on Weekend America. Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. And we've been asking you, what's the soundtrack to your weekend? The music that sets the tone for you when you're off the clock. We have been ricocheting across the country, hearing people's musical companions. We've heard old country, singer-songwriters, avant-garde. Jesse Lugas lives in St. Louis, Missouri, and listens to us on KWMU. He's finishing a PhD in molecular cell biology, and his weekend soundtrack is Midnight in a Perfect World by DJ Shadow. Oh, Jesse, I feel easygoing.
Yeah, as soon as I hear that opening, it calms me down. I feel my heart rate slowing. I'm relaxed. It's just fantastic. I love that.
What does it calm you down from?
Lately, it's been the stress of being a graduate student, just working, and having very little time to do other things. It's really my weekend soundtrack because it's the kind of thing that reminds me, all right, the week's over, so now you can put the successes and the failures sort of behind you and sort of move forward and do hopefully more pleasurable things.
Why is this the song that takes you to that stress-free place?
I first heard this when I was an undergrad in the University of Wisconsin, and I started listening to it a lot during one summer, and it was the kind of thing that I was always falling asleep to. And I just had this fantastic summer that was very relaxing. I sort of had a lot of time to myself. Both my roommates were gone. It takes me back to sort of being like, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, heading home, and knowing I'm going to get to go to sleep pretty soon. And just everything is right, and everything is good in the world.
What is lab life like? A lot of us don't know what that world is like.
It can be pretty grueling. It can be filled with a lot of frustration. There's a very famous scientist named Judah Folkman, and he has this quote that I'm probably going to botch, that something like, successful science is a single success in a desert of failure. And that's, sometimes things are pretty rough. You know, you leave the lab, you know, it can be late and just nothing went right. But it's a lot of time being very meticulous. You really have to have a lot of focus. You know, it's hard to do other things while you're doing lab work. I have a hard time listening to music or listening to, like, the radio, because you have to be paying attention to everything you're doing. Every little bit of liquid you're moving around or every piece of tissue you're moving, you have to sort of make sure you don't mix anything up. Otherwise, you could set yourself back over a month.
Title mean to you, Midnight in a Perfect World?
It holds the promise. You know, it's sort of, the perfect world is, you know, it's different things for different people, but midnight means it's the end of one day and the beginning of a new one. And so midnight in a perfect world is sort of the beginning of another great day. And you can sort of make that happen for yourself.
Jesse Lugas, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Again, Jesse's song was Midnight in a Perfect World by DJ Shadow. So what about you? What song is the soundtrack to your weekend? Maybe the backdrop to your greatest day ever? Maybe a song with sentimental value, or the one that gets you out and active on the weekends? In the soundtrack to your life, what song plays when the weekend comes around? And please tell us the story behind it at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke, joined by John Moe in Seattle. Our program is about the American weekend. And this weekend, Kenneth Liebrecht is not in America. He's in Ontario, Canada, where there's a chance of snow, and he must be shivering blissfully. Liebrecht is a professor of physics at Caltech in Southern California, and he's a photographer who takes pictures of snowflakes. About twice a year, he leaves California and goes somewhere snowy with his camera, and the photographs are unreal. If you are computer adjacent, you can go to weekendamerica.org and look at them while you listen to Kenneth Liebrecht describe the beauty that falls to Earth mostly unnoticed.
Yeah, I'm kind of the snowflake guy, the snowflake expert, you might say. My name is Ken Liebrecht. I'm a professor of physics at Caltech, and I study the physics of how crystals grow, how ice crystals grow, and I like to photograph snowflakes. Well, they are somewhat ephemeral. I mean, first of all, you have to come and wait for it to snow, and then I have essentially a piece of cardboard, and I let the crystals fall on the cardboard. I mean, you can't look at them on the ground. They sort of undergo changes, and after a very short time, they don't look very nice when they're on the ground anymore. So they have to be falling out of the sky. And then I take a close look and try to find nice-looking ones, photogenic snowflakes, if you will. And then I pick up an individual snowflake with a little paintbrush and drop it onto a microscope slide, and I have a special-made microscope for photographing snowflakes. I just snap the picture. And yes, you do break a lot, but, you know, they are falling out of the sky, so one just goes and gets another one. Snowflakes come in a lot of different varieties people don't usually think about. We're all used to the kind of snowflakes you see in advertisements around Christmas time and in the middle of the winter, the stellar crystals with branching and you know, six-fold symmetry. And those are common, but there's lots of other different types too. Like capped columns, where the columns have two plates growing on either end. Arrowhead-type crystals, which look a little like arrowheads. There are simple stars and fern-like stellar dendrites, which have lots of branching and side branching. It's surprising how much variety of different crystal types you can find. Well, when I'm photographing, I like to look for beautiful stellar crystals because they can be very elaborate and very lacy and really a lot of fun to look at. And those are just because they're interesting. They're unusual. And one of the things I like to do, because I'm involved with understanding the physics of this, is just try to understand how they form. And so when I see a funny-looking snow crystal, I can sort of try to puzzle over where it came from and how it got that shape. So I do some of that, too. The best place. Every place is. I mean, Miami is very bad. Los Angeles is bad. I like places where it's very cold because the best crystals form when it's maybe 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's pretty cold. I've been up in Alaska, and Vermont is good. Northern Michigan, where it snows about an inch a day, sometimes producing some very nice crystals as well. So lots of places. And I will camp out and wait for it to snow. And sometimes I will wait around till 2 in the morning to get really nice-looking snowflakes to photograph. And so I never really know exactly what I'm going to find when I go out looking. You know, I find it's really fun. To me, it's like the most fun you can have out in the snow when it's snowing anyway. And I just wanted to say, since it's a weekend show and you're sort of telling people about what people do and what they might want to think about doing, is I'm always encouraging people to get a little magnifying glass next time it snows and go outside and have a look at what's falling out of the sky. You really might be surprised at how interesting it is.
Kenneth Liebrecht is a physics professor, oddly located at Caltech here in Southern California. You can see his beautiful photographs on our website, weekendamerica.org.
Okay, has this ever happened to you? It's the weekend, maybe you're at a party or out for dinner or drinks. Maybe it's a situation where you don't know everyone all that well and you want to break the ice. You want to make things more comfortable, right? Well, you could talk about the weather or you could tell a joke. Thing is, you're rusty with jokes. Our society is now built on emailing people or texting, so you don't actually speak to humans as much as previous generations did. You might not even know any jokes. And the last thing you want in the world is to attempt a joke and then blow it. Well, the website comicwonder.com recently launched an effort to revive the dying art of joke telling. They offered $2,500 and a free t-shirt to the world's best joke teller. The winner was Chris Cashman of Seattle, and he joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What advice can you give people so they can go out this weekend and tell an effective joke? What are some tips on how to do it right?
I just think the old-fashioned joke telling, you know, the things you get forwarded, you know, the policeman, the horse, and the rabbi walk into a bar and the bartender says, wait a minute, this is a joke, right? You know, I mean, I think those things people see coming a million miles away and it's sort of boring in a way. I think that, you know, by taking either something that's slightly amusing and making it your own and or adding voices to it, and the beauty of doing it on the web is that you really can add sound effects to it. I think it's sort of like supersizing a joke, you know, take it and sort of rewrite it. And, you know, you get the same effect, same punchline, same conclusion. But what can you add to it? You know, what made you sort of chuckle about it and then sort of blow that part up?
The act of telling a joke to a friend at a party, at dinner, whatever it is, not so common anymore. Are jokes in better shape or worse shape than they used to be because of this, the modern methods of joke telling?
I would say they're in worse shape. I think, you know, joke telling is, unless you're somebody who goes to comedy clubs and things like that, you know, it is sort of going away. People don't really do that anymore. You don't hear people come up to you and go, hey, heard a funny joke, because when's the last time you heard a joke? You know, you probably got 10 in your inbox today, but people just don't tell jokes anymore.
And have you ever actually been in a bar and seen a priest, a rabbi, and a Lutheran pastor walk in?
No.
With or without a duck?
I haven't. I saw a horse in a bar one time.
Yeah?
But that was, you know, it was like a rodeo theme thing, and so it had nothing to do with humor whatsoever. And I thought it was leading to a punchline. It did not, in fact.
I kind of thought it was going to lead to a punchline just now when you said, I saw a horse in a bar once.
That's the beauty of comedy, see?
And then you assumed
that was a joke, and in fact, there's nothing at the end of that. Nothing.
Chris Cashman is the 2007 Comic Wonder of the Year, winner of $2,500 and a fancy t-shirt from the website comicwonder.com.
Yeah.
He is recognized as the global champion of joke telling and defies all challengers who seek to usurp his throne.
Unless you're really funny, then do not compete with me.
Give us a bit of the award-winning form. Show us how you won the $2,500 and the free t-shirt.
A brother's heading over to his sister's house. They get together every week, and they have the following conversation. Hey, what's going on? How you doing?
Oh, it's pretty good. I'm just, you know, just hanging out and everything.
Great. So we're going to do our usual, just watch a movie and relax?
Actually, I was thinking this could be fun. I bought a jigsaw puzzle. It's a real fun one. I've been working on it for like 4 days. It's really confusing, but I thought it could be fun if we did it together, maybe.
All right. Well, you know, whatever. Do you have the box so I know what it's supposed to look like?
Yeah, hang on. It's right over here. Here it is. It looks like it's a tiger. I've only got like part of the foot put together.
This is it?
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? I mean, I don't want to make a big deal out of it. I don't want to waste our time. I just don't think we're going to be able to, you know, actually make this look anything like the picture. So maybe we just watch a movie and relax. And
give me some credit. I know I'm your sister, but come on. I mean, I'm pretty smart. Let's do it together.
No, it's not that. It's just, you know, again, let's just watch a movie. We'll relax. And then maybe later on I can help you put all of the Frosted Flakes back into the box.
Chris Cashman is a voice actor in Seattle. He also hosts an online TV show for Microsoft. We have a link to Chris's championship joke-telling form. He goes by the handle Captain Hilariousness. That's at our website, weekendamerica.org.
And you'll have a little more time for jokes this weekend, or for resting, or for honoring the work of Dr. King, for this is a three-day weekend. There are only five of them all year, federal ones anyway, and because people pack them with adventure or remembrance, something special, three-day weekends tend to be memorable. And we're producing a series about three-day weekends in America. We want to hear your best personal stories of adventure that could only happen when leisure time expands. So if you're in the middle of a memorable three-day weekend right now, or you want to share a story of a three-day weekend you'll never forget, we want to hear about it. To tell us your three-day weekend story, go to our website, weekendamerica.org. And this three-day weekend means you'll have an extra day to shiver. Here is John Moe's take on this weekend's weather.
Bemidji, Minnesota hosts Bemidji Polar Days Festival and rarely has a city so skillfully named an occasion. A high of -4, you heard me, for sled derby, broomball, golf on ice, and yep, a polar bear plunge, followed by presumably ambulance rides for everyone. Make sure to dress in layers in that -4-degree weather, about 40,000 layers. Parades to celebrate 4th of July or Thanksgiving are all well and good, but what about really important holidays? Rockland, Maine comes through with a parade honoring National Pie Day. Stroll under clouds in 30 degrees and sample pies at five historic inns in Rockland. Cows in nearby fields have helpfully produced some pies as well, but just leave them be. You never know what the weather will do in Flagstaff, Arizona this time of year, thus the snow or no snowshoe race. Will there be snow? No. Sun in 39 as contestants tramp through wet, chilly grass for 10K, 5K, or 2K. I guess it's safer than a no-snow ski jumping contest, although that one is pretty interesting to imagine, isn't it? For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America. There are sports fans, dedicated sports fans, obsessed sports fans, and five notches above that, North Carolina basketball fans. Worshiping at the House of Tar Heel, just ahead.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe, along with Bill Radke. We're a few weeks away from March Madness, college basketball's season-ending tournament, but in North Carolina, madness is not confined to March. This afternoon in Chapel Hill, the University of North Carolina Tar Heels tip off against Maryland, and Will Blythe will be watching. Will says basketball isn't really a sport in North Carolina. It's closer to religion, and he belongs to the Church of the Tar Heels. Will attempts to explain his fandom, particularly in opposition to arch-rival Duke, in his book, To Hate Like This is to Be Happy Forever. Here's Will reading a passage.
I am a sick, sick man. Not only am I consumed by hatred, I am delighted by it. I have done some checking into the matter and have discovered that the world's great religions and wisdom traditions tend to frown upon this. Therefore, dear reader, I need your prayers. But even more than I do, the University of North Carolina's basketball team, the object of my obsession, needs them. Here is the depth of my sickness. It is several years back on a beautiful afternoon during basketball season. The cable is out. Note to self, kill Time Warner. I am alone in my apartment in New York City, frantically hitting the refresh button on my computer screen, getting the updates of Carolina's shockingly bad performance against its arch-rival Duke. So far, the Tar Heels have shot 18 three-pointers and hit exactly five. There is no end to my gloom. My father is in his grave. My marriage is kaput. My girlfriend is said to be in Miami, though what she is doing there, I can't say, since we're not speaking. I have no income. And yet, the thing that is driving me over the edge is a basketball game that I can't even see. North Carolina, my beloved North Carolina, is being brutalized by Duke, being outplayed by opponents who are too kind, too mannerly even to gloat. At least when your rival gloats, you know victory over you means something. Again and again, I hit the refresh button and am transported anew to a message board, resounding with rending cries and moans from fellow Carolina obsessives, posting their dismay, miss by brutal miss. It's like tuning in to the distracted mutterings of old men alone on park benches all over America. There are so many of us. One fan writes, I may have to sit out this year with a bad back, a pointed reminder of the hated Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski's condition during the 1994-95 season, when the Blue Devils suffered a beautifully horrible time of it, finishing 13-18. Overburdened, Krzyzewski took a leave of absence from coaching that year. Rumors swirled through the research triangle of the Duke coach in tears, huddled in his bedroom, wrapped in a bathrobe, muttering more inanities than Dick Vitale. Now, the normal human certainly would feel sympathy for a man in such pain. But I am a North Carolina fan, and by definition, at least when it comes to Duke, not a normal man. From time to time, I have felt silly about this devotion to a college team and the concomitant hatred of its rival. Here I am, a grown man, huddled in front of a TV, hiding out from the world from November to April, watching students battle each other in games that shouldn't mean more to me than to them, right? Not long ago, as I watched Carolina endure a particularly ugly sequence against Duke, I scared my girlfriend's 9-year-old son, Harry. I had already terrified the dog, the beloved Gracie, who had fled into the bathroom to avoid my raving. Duke's Dante Jones had just driven home a particularly obnoxious dunk and was now flexing his muscles like an insane bodybuilder. Was there no justice in the universe? Where was God? I pounded my hand on the coffee table, stomped my feet on the floor, and exclaimed with extreme eloquence, damn it. And don't say what I just said, Harry. Indeed, I felt proud of myself that I had limited my profanity to just these few words, a virtual Zen master of self-control. Harry, who had been watching me watch the game, asked, "Why do you have to get so mad?" Normally, he would have delighted in an adult swearing, but now he was edging backward across the room, the way people will when you have a gun pointed at them. His eyes were wide. "Because I hate Duke," I explained. "Why do you hate them?" he asked. Here I hesitated. A young boy had asked me a guileless question, and he needed an adult response. "Well, that's an interesting question," I told him, channeling Mr. Rogers, "and it deserves an honest answer." I paused for a moment, as I had seen his mother do when addressing an earnest inquiry by her son. "Children are our future. We must teach them well, even when it is hard." "The truth is, they are terrible people," I told him, "detestable." "All of them?" he asked. "Every last one of them," I said, "especially the coach." "I hate them too," Harry said, settling in next to me on the couch. And thus was born another soldier in the war. On the door of his room hung a chalkboard for self-expression, and I was pleased to note that now, scrawled in his child's hand, with no assistance or prodding from me, was the unimpeachable sentiment, "No Duke fans allowed in here."
Will Blythe, he's the author of To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, a thoroughly obsessive, intermittently uplifting, and occasionally unbiased account of the Duke-North Carolina basketball rivalry. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, weekendamerica.org. And Bill, you're going right into that next week, aren't you?
Yes, I'll be hosting next week's show from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina.
Okay, so Bill, are you a Duke fan or a North Carolina fan?
Zero comment on that.
You don't need that kind of danger.
I don't need that, no.
Okay. How about that, though? I mean, do you think to get that stressed out and anxiety riddled, do you think that helps?
I say life? No. I say it creates new venom and it's bad news.
Okay. I don't know. It leads to more passion and maybe more ulcers.
Yes, both. I hope you can join us next week in North Carolina. And that's it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Special thanks today to ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina, and to partner station KUOW in Seattle. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Nelia Lell, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, Shirley Shin, E. Okobie, and Tim Bomba.
Also Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. And I hope you'll take our podcast. It's there for free, right, of our show from our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
I'm John Mo. We're leaving the podcast on the table. All you need to do is walk over, pick it up, stuff it in your bag. I'm in for Desiree Cooper. She'll be back next weekend. Have a great weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.